In her latest book, 7 Days in the Art World, Sarah Thornton reveals several little-known facts about New York City's art scene. For example, blue and red paintings are more likely to sell than brown ones. Happy paintings sell better than glum ones. And any piece of art too big to fit into a Park Avenue freight elevator probably won't sell at all. Miss Thornton, who was once the... I'm getting lost here. Once described as Britain's hippest academic by the London Daily Telegraph, interviewed 250 people and visited 6 countries to create this portrait of the highly competitive contemporary art market. The book is published by Norton. I'm very pleased that it brings Sarah Thornton to the show today. Hi. Now, this book focuses on a rarefied world in which paintings fetch millions of dollars and collectors jockey to purchase work by the hottest contemporary artists. But the New York Times has been reporting that the recent economic downturn has had a dramatic impact on the prices people are willing to pay for contemporary art. Few collectors are viewing the current market as a great time for bargain hunters. Is the art market similar to the housing market, where everyone assumed that the prices would just go up, up, and up?
I think there are a lot of similarities between the housing market and the art market. I guess the difference this week is that while the real estate market seems to be pretty well frozen, kind of paralyzed, there have actually been sales and even record prices going on. Sotheby's had their big evening sale on Tuesday night. Christie's had their big evening sale last night. Both of them sold 68% of the work that was available. And
but weren't they disappointed that everything came in below estimate?
Certainly there's been a major price readjustment, and they are back down to 2005 or 2006 prices. But to be honest, the prices have been so crazy. 2005 prices are still actually very high.
So how much of the dramatic increase in prices that we've seen over the past decade have been due to collectors being willing to pay more for objects they admire, and how much has been due to speculators hoping to buy low and sell even higher?
I think it's a combination of both. I think there was a moment when a lot of people came into the market. Art became much more popular. You know, you had to have it on your walls to be part of the social club. I think there's also a genuine interest in art, growing interest. It has to do with the fact that we're better educated than we ever were, but perhaps read less than we used to. We're interested in visual stimulation. It's a kind of YouTube generation phenomenon. And so you had collectors coming in the United States, but also globally, which is a new phenomenon. Contemporary art used to be American and European, but now we have, you know, and last year in particular, in terms of buyers, we had a lot of Asian and Middle Eastern buyers and Russian buyers coming in to the market.
The Japanese especially love Van Gogh.
The Japanese were a huge factor in the last art boom, 88, 89, 90. And they have had less money to spend in the past few years. Koreans have been important, and Hong Kong Chinese, Malaysians have, you know, been buying Warhols and Francis Bacons at extremely high prices.
In recent years, haven't some collectors been stockpiling contemporary art?
I think stockpiling is perhaps more common than it used to be.
Is that in hopes of selling it later, or they just... Getting a lot of stuff that they like.
I mean, I think there are definitely speculators and people who call themselves collectors who are actually dealers. In fact, there are some dealers out there who hang on to their works for longer than some so-called collectors. But I think there are also genuine hoarders, you know, amassers, people who are, you know, collect and keep it. And there are definitely more collectors with huge warehouses full of work.
How much are people willing to risk? I'm assuming that buying work by a young living artist is riskier than buying a painting by somebody who's already established in the history books, even if it's somebody as recent as Andy Warhol.
I think over the past 5 years and up until recently, risk was part of the thrill and excitement of contemporary art. I think what we've seen in the past month with the recent sales, and certainly in the past week of sales in New York, is a return to the safety of dead artists.
So people are less likely to buy a Jeff Koons or a Damien Hirst because they're not sure that they will continue to appreciate in value?
I think the past few nights have borne witness to that, actually. Hirst and Koons are slightly different. Hirst had a huge straight out of the studio sale in Sotheby's in London on the 15th of September. 223 lots were all Hirst went up for auction in a 24-hour period. And it was surreal to be there because it was the evening sale was the day the Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And everything was selling in that room. It was almost like the Russians, I think they were a key factor, were on a spending spree. And it was almost like something out of a Cold War science fiction novel. You wouldn't have imagined it. And so there's been a lot of Hirst on the market. And I think in the short term, it's going to be hard to sell Hirst because there are just too many of them around. And I think with Koons, it depends what it is and the price.
Well, you've written that contemporary art has become so popular among collectors partly because it is so expensive. So will people be less interested if the prices begin to drop?
You know, that's really hard to say. I think there was a moment in this boom economy where conspicuous consumption and bling was very much in fashion. And people like to point at something at the wall on a wall, and its high price was part of its allure. I think in this cultural climate that we're entering, that is unlikely to be the case.
Because there was in the New York Times the other day, one collector was bragging that he was getting things at a much lower price than he could have in the past. And as long as it's available at below what was market value, he was going to buy up as much as he could.
One of the things people talk about is that perhaps in a bear art market, people will actually be able to see the work and look at its meanings and richness in ways other than monetary value.
My guest is Sarah Thornton. Her book, 7 Days in the Art World, is published by Norton. You have written a chapter about a specific day you spent visiting and studying one segment of the contemporary art world. You attended an auction at Christie's, an art criticism seminar at the California Institute of the Arts, the Basel Art Fair, the 2007 Venice Biennale, looked in on jury deliberations at the Turner Prize. You visited Takashi Murakami Studios in Japan and Art Forum Magazine's offices in New York. Why did you choose those in particular?
Well, the art world, I see the art world as a kind of overlapping cluster of squabbling subcultures that really don't agree with each other in many different ways. And so it's very hard to represent the whole gamut, the diversity out there of artist, critic, curator, dealer, and collector opinion. And so I thought the best way to do it was just to kind of like plunge myself into different experiential worlds and try to write them up as a day in the life so the reader could feel like they were there with me and really experience them. So, you know, the auction takes place at Rockefeller Center at an evening sale in November 2004, which was really when the boom really started to take off. And then the chapter two is kind of the absolute opposite. It's a crit class out at CalArts in L.A. where these artist students are really learning how to be artists, learning how to occupy that role, how to talk about their work and perform for each other, actually.
And that's always been a problem for artists. They more and more now they have to go and sell themselves. You go to a gallery and you have to sell yourself and be able to talk about your work. In the past, you just assumed that you could be as inarticulate as you were, and the work would speak for itself.
I think taciturn painters have it rough nowadays, definitely. I think the thing is, in that crit, they don't really talk about the outside world in terms of dealers and curators and how to get ahead. Those are almost taboo subjects, and they really do focus on the conceptual ideas and very specific ideas going on in their artworks. And I mean, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because the art world in general and the art market is not really on the curriculum in art schools. And this is something that a lot of art students might want to read.
And you do learn really interesting facts. For example, your chapter on the Christie's auction. Can you tell us about how the seating works at these auctions? People actually sit in certain areas to reveal their status.
It is quite incredible, actually. You know, the aisle seats tend to be the most coveted, and you have the most powerful dealers and collectors sat on the aisles in the center. It depends whether you're at Christie's or Sotheby's. You know, the seating arrangements vary a little bit. You have certain people who always like to sit in the front row. Then they'll have, you know, certain, you know, not so good seats that are right under the nose of the press pack. And then there are all sorts of people who can't get in at all, and some people who have standing room. And
but there are the people who are likely to bid sit together, people who may bid but probably won't sit in a different section.
And then also there are the consigners who are up in these sky boxes with, you know, champagne service behind glass and potentially behind curtains. Selling is not seen as quite the victory that buying is, and so they often like to stay behind the scenes.
You also point out that most of Christie's auctioneers are foreign-born. Is it because their accents give their words more style?
You know, I guess, you know, selling can be seen as a profane act with regard to art, and perhaps the Swiss or the British or the Austrian accent lend a little dignity to the flogging of this stuff. But it is the case that at all three of the main contemporary auction houses that they are, none of them are American, none of the top auctioneers.
The day you were at Christie's, November 2004, a painting by Marlene Dumas sold for over $1 million, making it only the third painting by a living female artist to sell over $1 million. Has that changed?
You know, it has changed, but women still sell for less. Last night, actually, there was a worldwide record for a living woman artist, and that was Yayoi Kusama's 1959 painting. And it was really rather exciting, and the room clapped. And in general, though, women's work fares much less well at auction than men's.
And some women have told me, at least in the past, that dealers, even women who are dealers, would say, I love your work, but I'm not going to take you on because you're less likely to attract buyers.
Really? You know, I've never heard. No, nobody's ever told me that, but I'm not surprised. You know, it's a very complicated thing. I think that, you know, you often have a situation where in a group show at a museum, they will be careful to make sure a third of the women are artists. A third of the women works represented are by women artists.
But that's only after a lot of picketing in front of museums over the years.
But then by the time you get into the auction room, the percentage is even smaller. And you might go to an evening sale with 65 lots and only three of them by women. So the higher up you go, the worse it is, kind of like maybe the banking world. And you'd think the art world would be a little bit more vanguard.
Why do you think people go to auctions rather than to dealers? Because often what we hear that some of the best art was bought because of a good relationship established between a buyer and a dealer.
I think there are several factors there. One, kind of cultivating gallerists to be, you know, first in line for the best piece is a very time-consuming activity that and is almost like a full-time hobby and sometimes a job for some collectors. And not all collectors have time for that, particularly foreign ones. Other people like the reassurance that is being vetted once or twice, and so they prefer to buy resale, which is what the auction world is, rather than directly from a dealer where the artist actually gets a percentage.
You think it's also that you're seen at an auction? There's just the societal aspect to it?
Absolutely. I mean, some people like the public buy, like being part of the theater. And see, you know, a good seat at auction in an auction room as a mark of their social status, and they like, you know, to bid in the room. Other people prefer to bid on the phone and prefer it for it not to be known that they've purchase something, and sometimes it takes years to find out who bought it.
What about the art fairs? You covered the Basel Art Fair. Is that another way of buying in public?
You know, the fairs are murkier, much more opaque, and I kind of see that. You know, in every chapter in this book, there's a slightly different definition of art going on. They all see art as kind of meaning-making and thought-provoking, but it varies. And even between the two market chapters, the auction and the fair, you know, in the auction, art is an investment and a luxury good. But in the fair, it's much more of a fetish and a kind of obsessive commodity. And it does have to do with the fact that some people are buying secondary market and or resale at auction, and others are buying on the primary market. And you know, people who buy at a fair are much more likely to want to meet the artist and, you know, be at the artist dinner and involved and go to artist studios and be more involved on that level. And, of course, there are a lot of people who do both, you know, go to the fair and the auction.
My guest is Sarah Thornton, who writes about the art world and the art market for many publications, including Art Forum, the art newspaper. She's written for The New Yorker, contributed several BBC TV programs. Her book, 7 Days in the Art World, is published by Norton. You mentioned that there's a blur between what is art and what isn't, and that leads me to Takashi Murakami, the only individual artist that you chose to profile. He runs an art factory of sorts, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost post-factory. It's almost a digital design lab. One of the characters in the book, Scott Rothkopf, who's a senior editor at Art Forum, he says that Murakami's, you know, setup makes Warhol's look like a lemonade stand. And I think that is true. We have moved on. Murakami not only makes paintings and sculptures, but he also kind of reinvented the Louis Vuitton logo in a very colorful way, which became a best-selling handbag. And he's made videos for Kanye West. And he's very kind of high-low. He works in many different ways. And he's also someone who's very obsessed with the craftsmanship as well as the concept, which makes him kind of one part of a post-conceptual group.
And that high-low, I would assume, is part of the appeal, the way he has successfully blurred or flattened the distinction between commercial and fine art. He was also the subject of a major show at the Brooklyn Museum, and I wonder if that doesn't also tell us something about contemporary museum shows and what museums are looking for today.
Well, I think Murakami appeals to a lot of people on a lot of levels because he is, he has a PhD in painting, and he is extremely knowledgeable about art, and there's a lot of richness in his art from an art point of view. But then he's working the popular in so many different domains. And so I actually went to his opening at MoCA LA. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend the Brooklyn one because I live in London. But I couldn't believe the diversity of the crowd. You know, there were like old Japanese men and young hip, African-American hip-hop dudes. And it was not like a regular museum opening in the evening, you know.
But I would assume that that kind of museum exhibit would give credibility to an artist and boost sales.
You know, it's interesting, the relationship between, sales kudos in something like an auction room and popularity. I mean, they're not necessarily a one-to-one correlation. There are popular artists who don't have much credibility within the inner circles of the art world. It is each subculture is kind of like a club, and they may not want to let you in.
You explain in an author's note near the end of your book that you drew on what you learned studying art history as an undergraduate and studying sociology as a graduate student. Is that why you seem to be as interested in writing about what was going on around the art as you were about writing about the art itself?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are a lot of really wonderful art critics out there, and they are doing a fantastic job writing about the art itself. But there were many fewer people writing about everything going on around the art. And so having, you know, trained as an ethnographer, doing a sociology PhD, I thought I'd kind of turn those skills back onto my first love, which was art, and try to make sense of everything going on around the art. Because quite often, you know, work accrues value not only because of itself. You know, sometimes you wonder, why is that painting considered so good, and why is it selling for such a high price? And it definitely does have to do with in things, intrinsic, things that are lying there on the canvas, but also it has to do with all sorts of benchmarks of validation and legitimation, which have to do with, you know, oh, where did that artist get their MFA, and have they been reviewed in Art Forum, and have they been in this museum show, and have they got the stamp of approval of an award here or there? I mean, the whole way that consensus gets built up around an artist's work fascinates me.
Also, where they stand in the trend. If they're at the beginning of the trend, they're taken much more seriously. I've seen some pretty good artists who were told by galleries, I love your work, but, you know, we're past process art, or we're past whatever the thing is that you're doing right now. And so I'm not sure that I can sell it.
Well,
and they weren't only women.
Yeah.
And if they were women who got that kind of response, they might as well go into some other profession.
I think innovation is much celebrated within the art world, and it is... if there is a rule to the way things work, it's that rule breaking is sought after. And whether, most dealers see themselves as mavericks who are breaking the rules. Artists are doing it. Curators like to see they're breaking the mold. It is one of the things that's so wonderful about the art world is that people are trying to change, you know, aesthetics and social forms.
Although today being a little outrageous also seems to help. People like Damien Hirst cutting up animals or creating a sculpture that has millions of dollars worth of diamonds on it. Jeff Koons doing topiary that looks like a little like balloon art. I imagine that you make the big splash by doing the outrageous thing, or he did pornographic sculptures involving himself and mm-hmm. his ex-wife,
mm-hmm.
and then you sell the smaller piece, and everybody somehow basks in the glory.
Well, the whole praxis of making the very big, difficult work that's hard to sell, and then having works that sell more easily is something that a lot of artists did before these ones. I mean, Warhol, you know, funded his films by doing society portraits, and I think the diamond skull by Damien Hirst has not, to my knowledge, sold fully anyway. I think they sold off a bit of it. But, you know, he makes a lot of spot paintings and other decorative things to bankroll.
Sarah Thornton's book, 7 Days in the Art World, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.